The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Now I'll start. the Buddha has one son, and was documented that the Buddha left the palace, and he was the prince of kind of a kingdom or confederate, and he was supposed to inherit the throne, become the king. But he left the palace at the day when his son was born, and in search for his enlightenment. It was quite a dramatic story. And so that was the night he left when Rahula was born. And the story is that the Buddha was having deep calling in him. And he, when Rahula was born, and that night he decided that he needs to leave and search for awakening, enlightenment. And so the way he left, and the story said that both Buddha's wife and Rahula were asleep in the middle of the night, and the mother's hand was covering the little baby's face, and the Buddha didn't quite see the face, and he just got up and left the palace. And he left for 6 years, kind of learned from various masters and teachers and practiced himself. And after 6 years, Siddhartha, which was the Buddha's name, before he was enlightened, became the Buddha. And so 6 years later, he became the Buddha, and he was fully awakened. But he did not forget about his family. You know, he still has his foster mother and father in the kingdom, and his son, young son, Rahula, be 6-7 years old. So he wandered around and wandered back to his hometown. It took quite a long time, and apparently he has wandered quite far away from the home. And so it took some time for him to get back home. And along the way, there were a number of disciples. A number of the people had ordained under him and became his disciples. And so when he wandered back to his home, he came back with a whole bunch of disciples and his whole monastic order as well. And so when he got back home, his wife saw him coming. And so his wife told the Rahula, "Rahula, see, your daddy is coming home, and go ask him for his heritage." I guess, you know, that the young boy was supposed to inherit the kingdom, become the king as well at some point. And so he went to ask his dad for inheritance. And so Rahula went to see his dad, and apparently he was kind of attracted by something of Buddha's presence. And so the first thing he said to his father was, "Oh, your shadow is very pleasant." So it's hard for us to really kind of understand exactly what was exchanged. But I get the sense that, you know, he was feeling kind of some warmth or some pleasant presence with Buddha. And so he's kind of said that. And then he asked the Buddha for his heritage. And the Buddha turned around and asked one of his disciples, Sariputta, one of the greatest disciples of his order, "Go ordain Rahula." And so that was dramatic. I think the family didn't quite expect that to be the case. And the young Rahula became the novice monk in the monastic order. And there was an interesting side story that when the Buddha's father got to know this, and he kind of, I suspect, you know, he felt not quite comfortable with this. And so he actually asked the Buddha that it is important for the people who get ordained in the monastic order to have their parents' approval. And the Buddha thought that was a good proposal, and so he accepted that. And so now, even to date, when in the Buddhist tradition, when the people gets ordained into monastic order, they need to have family approval. And I was kind of inspired by this, that the Buddha, as a Buddha, wasn't at all kind of making big deal out of what he is and what the conventional rules might be or might not be and supposed to be. And he was very matter of fact. You know, if there is a need and it sounds reasonable and should be followed, he just accepted it as a rule. And he went on with that. And it seems to be a reasonable thing. So it wasn't like making a huge deal out of this or not. It's a kind of a little teaching for me to understand how we relate to rules and not rules in our own experiences. And so so that's a side story. And so maybe I'll fast forward a little bit just to tell you that there is a happy ending. So after Rahula was ordained, and as I mentioned, in 21-year-old, he became arahant, fully enlightened. And so, and that's the way Buddha had given his son his heritage. And then, you know, that was tremendous. You know, I oftentimes reflect what I wanted to give to my own son. And it's nothing more than true happiness, well-being. Yeah. And the Buddha was able to give this kind of deep sense of well-being to his son and full liberation. And not only that, through the Buddha's teachings, his wife also became fully enlightened, and his foster mother, we have a statue right out here, Mahapajapati, that's his foster mother, has also become one of the foremost monastic nun, and is also fully enlightened. And his father, before his death, also had certain levels of attainment to allow him to continue on this path of awakening. And so the Buddha wasn't simply leaving the family and not caring about them anymore. And he gave the best gift one can hope for to his family when he went back home. So it's really quite remarkable. And so in this first sutta that we'll talk about today, the Middle Length Discourses number 61, it documented something about what Buddha taught Rahula, the 7-year-old boy, something about truth and lies. And so, and he taught it in a very unique way. It was hard for one to imagine a seven-year-old, and the Buddha would ask him to meditate. It's probably difficult. My son came here for Dharma Sprouts and Dharma Rocks when he was, started a five-year-old. And very soon it became clear that this kid's it's impossible to have them sit still for, more than a minute or two without fidgeting and doing other things. It's not so much that... it's just the biology, that this kids at that age, it's hard to have the mental attention, stamina to kind of stay hold for long. But on the other hand, the young kids, their mind is wide open. They don't have a lot of knowledge and learnings in their head. And so the teachings can really sink in to them. And so Buddha used this opportunity and taught Rahula in very specific ways some very critical life skills and skillful actions to Rahula. And so the story goes that the Buddha was... meditating in a place close by to Rahula, and in the evening, Rahula and the Buddha got up from his meditation, and he went to see Rahula. And so when Rahula saw his father coming, and just know that Buddha have several different identities for Rahula, right? He's a father figure, but he's also a leader of the monastic order. He's an enlightened individual. And so he has some of this maybe quite significant roles in Rahula's life. So Rahula saw his father coming, and he prepared a bucket of water for his father to wash his feet. And that was the tradition in those days. Even in today's India, when you go to temple, you have to take a bath first before you enter the temple. It's kind of the tradition in those days. And so the Buddha washed his feet using the bucket and then sat down. And it was said that somehow that at that time, Rahula probably had told some lies. We don't know for sure. It wasn't in this particular sutta, but the commentary was saying Rahula probably said some lie. Like, I don't know, Today you can think of, you ask a child, did you take that chocolate? No? It can happen, right? And so it could be something like that. It could be something different. But the Buddha wants to teach him something about this. So after he sat down, he has this water bucket, he has a water bucket, and he poured a little bit of water into this water bucket, and then he showed the Rahula, look, there's a little bit of water in this bucket, right? Yes, Father, there's a little bit of water. And so the Buddha said, so let's see. What did he say exactly? So he said, "Oh, even so, Rahula, little is the recluseship of those who have no shame at telling deliberate lies." He's saying, "Look, there isn't much in any in individuals who are telling lies with no shame." There's not much in them, in the recluseship, especially in this kind of monastic order, right? But the Buddha isn't done with just that. He, in order to drive the message home, he continued on with this simile, analogy, and he kind of threw the water out of the bucket, and he asked the Rahula to see. Look, you know, the water is thrown out, right? Thrown away. Even so, Rahula, thrown away is the recluseship of those who have no shame at telling deliberate lies. And it's not just a little bit left in them. It's thrown away. And that's not enough. And the Buddha still wanted to drive the message home. He turned this water bucket upside down. He put it under the on the ground. He said, look, Rahula, overturned is the recluseship of those who have no shame at telling deliberate lies. So not just a little bit or thrown away, but completely upside down is those who telling lies, deliberate lies with no shame. And that's not enough. So he flipped the bucket back up and empty and showed Rahula, look, is this water bucket hollow and empty? And Rahula said, yes, this bucket is hollow and void and empty. Even so, Rahula, void and empty is the recluseship of those who have no shame at telling deliberate lies. And I can see this kind of a sequence of a simile kind of progressively is driving home this message of telling deliberate lies is really not to be done. Right? This is not good for a monk who ordained as a novice monk like Rahula. And you'd be completely hollow and empty when you're telling deliberate lie with no shame. And so I would imagine, you know, this really caught Rahula's attention. For a seven-year-old, this authoritative figure, father, telling him this. But the Buddha wasn't done with this. You know, he went on with yet another simile, piling on top of this. So, and this is about a war elephant. And I think Rahula and in those days, people who live in a palace probably know what the roles of war elephants are, and they were used to fight the wars. And so, so in one situation, when the elephant fights the war, he may go into the war, but he might still try to protect himself from being hurt, like protecting the trunk or some parts of the body. But there's another situation when the war elephant goes into the war zone. He or she might completely forget about his own life. He won't even worry about his own life. He would just charge ahead, throw himself or herself into the war completely. And so it's like that for those who have no shame telling deliberate lies. They can throw themselves, including their own life, into danger, and they can do no. There's no evil they would not do. So that was the other simile that the Buddha kind of piled on to this young boy. I said, "Look, you know, if you're telling lie with no shame, you could have your own life in danger, and you could do all kinds of evil in your life." And so that must be a real dramatic kind of scene that the Buddha created for Rahula. And after talking about this whole sequence of things, the Buddha instructed Rahula. So, wherefore for you, Rahula, I will not tell a lie, not even for fun. He's saying, not even for jokes or fun, and you should not tell the lie. And this is how you should train yourself. This is how you must train yourself, Rahula. So you can see, you know, this way of building up the climax of the instruction probably was quite effective for Rahula. It was really kind of highlighting why you should not do this. And for you, your training is not to tell a lie, not even for fun. And I remember, I remember seeing or kind of experiencing young kids. When we tell deliberate lies or tell lies, our biological and psychological bodies do not feel safe. You know, it's always kind of a little shaky somehow. It wasn't quite right. And the Buddha used this sequence of a simile and really kind of hit home what one should do and not to harm oneself in ways. And so, besides that, what's more interesting is that the Buddha didn't stop just at this. It wasn't just stopping at telling Rahulan what not to do. But rather, the Buddha used yet another simile, analogy, to teach Rahula some critical skills to be learned. And so he talked about a mirror. He asked Rahula, "Oh, what is the mirror used for?" "A mirror is used for reflecting. It's a reflecting things that is in front of it." And so the Buddha described how one should reflect one's actions before, during, or after one has taken the action, and that there are three types of actions: the bodily action, you know, the moving and doing things, and verbal action, what we say, and the mental action, and our thoughts. And so he's asking Rahula to frequently reflect when we take actions, whether it's bodily, verbal, or mental. And in one case, you should repeatedly reflect before you take action. Reflect to yourself. Is the action I'm about to take going to lead to self-afflictions, affliction in others, or both? Or is it leading to happiness in oneself, others, or both? And that's before. Before you take action and you reflect this. And then during the action, when you're taking the action, also reflect the same way. Is it going to lead to harm for yourself and others, or both? Or is it going to lead to happiness for oneself, others, and both? And having done an action, also reflect the same way. What consequences does it lead to? Harm or happiness? And the Buddha said that all the sages of the past, the future, and the present all reflected like this. And so you should train yourself to do this repeated reflections as well. I was quite touched by this instructions and teachings to Rahula. Because this kind of reflection requires some critical skills, multiple qualities that can come together in order to fulfill them. And so, for example, it requires one to pay attention when you're taking your actions and contemplate and also observe the cause and effects of your actions, right? Is the action going to be skillful, leading to good consequences, or is it going to lead to afflictions? And so without necessarily asking a young kid to sit still, meditate, observe, paying attention, and he introduced this whole set of practices that one should take to cultivate our awareness and discernment and wisdom through taking actions, but repeatedly reflect what is happening, what is about to happen, and what has already happened. And in this way, he kind of invited this young kid to really be able to, over time, develop the qualities that are critical on the path of awakening. Kind of a full discernment about what is leading to the true well-being versus leading to stress and suffering. Now, understanding causes and effects of one's actions. And so it's really quite remarkable, you know, how skillful the Buddha had taught Rahula this set of things, and one, to prevent him from taking actions that are unskillful by telling him not to tell the lies, but also more importantly, you know, to ask Rahula to really, on an ongoing basis, develop this capacity to reflect and pay attention and understand the consequences. And so I was quite touched by the set of instructions and teachings. And oftentimes people might interpret that this first teaching that the Buddha gave to his son was around virtue and morality. But to me, it's more than that. It's really including the critical skills of awareness and discernment and cultivation of wisdom. And so, but in a way that a seven-year-old is able to relate to. You know, a seven-year-old would do things, right? And they'll talk and they'll think, and that's some things that they can understand. And if this message registered in him deeply, and he would be able to really repeatedly train himself to reflect and then observe carefully. And so I was quite touched by this. So I guess the sutta ended with that the Rahula was happy at the end of the conversation. So that was the first story. And about truth and the lies, and how the Buddha taught his son in a very skillful way. And then this is the kind of actions, for me, if I reflected upon this, something that is very useful for adults to do as well, on repeated fashion. Reflect before we take actions. Reflect when we're taking actions, and reflect when the actions are done. So, I think I'm going to stop for now and see if there's any questions and comments that you'd like to share with the group. Anyone? Yeah. Well, if not, you have any questions or comments?
One odd comment, which is sort of besides the point of the lesson. I got very thrown off by the fact that he basically abandoned his wife and child. And,
yeah.
And no one, didn't sound like he ever addressed it, or we don't know about it if he did.
Yeah, so it's great that you pointed that out. I think for many years, for many people, and that was a challenging thing to really understand. How could someone, you know, who has a newborn as a father, would just go for his own enlightenment and you know, leave the baby and the wife? Yeah, it was something that bothered me for some time as well. But if I reflect upon this, there are multiple things that came up for me. One is, it does occur to me that the Buddha has a quite strong resolve in the search of his awakening. You know, and the story was, before this, he went out of the palace, kind of and saw illness, aging, death, and was struck by it, and figured, gee, you know, that's going to be me too, and how am I going to get out of this? And when Rahula was born, and Rahula was named Rahula, it means fetter, which is an impediment to awakening. And so there may be a deep sense that this is going to really, you know, one interpretation is that this might really tie the Buddha down, right? One commentary was saying that he was named a fetter. Rahula means a fetter. But his drive for in searching for something that transcend all of this, illness, aging, death, and bondage, was so strong that he had to leave. But I was inspired that he didn't just leave them, that's it, period. He did come back, and he gave the best gift that one could hope for to his family. And so that was kind of, for me, was kind of brought a sense of ease and understanding of what this might take. I think for a lot of a conventional wisdom, it's hard to understand how could this, you know, how could he do this, right? And shouldn't there be a better way to do this? And we don't know, but this is how the story unfolded. Thank you for asking.
There's never mention of him making amends or acknowledging it, or
I think amends is for us to relate to from his perspective. What he could hope for is to offer the best that he could to have his family be awakened, and so maybe amends isn't necessary, or amends is kind of maybe a side point. And so he went, there's no mentioning of that in the suttas. And so mostly what is being said is he offered to give teachings to his family. And probably in those days, also in the tradition, and there may be a particular way one holds up an enlightened individual. So that way of, you know, amend or sorry may not necessarily kind of be in the culture when the Buddha is coming back as a full enlightened individual. I don't know. It's hard to unpack from where we are on that. But I would say the happy news is that, you know, the family, a lot of them had a lot of the relatives and cousins and all, you know, went to the monastic order and ultimately became enlightened individuals. And so, Yes.
Immigrating to another country to make a better life for their family. You know, it seems really mean to be away from your family and the move, but the intent is to create a better life. And so that's the way I'm kind of relating to it.
Oh, I'm glad you said that, because I have my own my own situation as well. My father came here when, you know, I was a teenager for many years, and he all by himself here in America. And I grew up for the teenager years without my dad around. But I'm grateful that I, without him laying the path and being here, I would probably not have had opportunity to encounter what I'm encountering right now. the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, and the life I have here. And so, yeah, thank you for bringing that up. Yeah. We don't always know. Yeah, so all we can say is we have the best of our intention, and that was what we felt like was the right thing to do. Yeah. So, yes, Morgan, yes.
I was going to say too, because that really bothered me when I first read it, that and there is a piece, because I have three kids, and I know that in some ways they are, I love them so much, but they are fetters to my path and my journey. You know, I really struggle with that, because I can't make some of the decisions I make. I do to keep them kind of in the conditioned world, going to school, going to college. I can't take them, or I feel like I can't take them out of what's normal in this culture that's selfish of me to do. But in some ways, I mean, it's so hard. It's kind of my journey to have that fetter to my practice, and I wish I was more courageous and could step out, because it would be. When I look at my parents, and one of the best gifts they could ever have given me is to become enlightened or to be fulfilled, and however that was. And I don't think either of my parents will make it to that point in really any way. What a great gift if they had managed to do that. That would have been the most amazing. You know, it's to see people you love find peace. And so they're the, you know, piece of me. I wish I could be more courageous, because I think the ultimate gift would be amazing for them to have a mom.
Yeah.
That journeyed that way. But I'm held back a lot, because yeah. I'm like, yeah, I got to make it so that they stay in school and they can have normal lives. And that means that X, Y, and Z has to happen.
Yeah.
But if I could be more brave,
Yeah, I think that's right. And you said you're absolutely right. I think the conditions that the Siddhartha was in is quite different. You know, he has a whole family structure, and that is supporting his family and his wife and the little baby. Grandparents were there. It's a palace. You know, his father was a king, and his wife was there. So there are lots of conditions, because Buddha was a very compassionate and kind individual, you know, even when he was very young and, you know, growing up to that age before he left. What hard for me to imagine if the conditions weren't there, and he would just, at the cost of creating significant harm, to leave the family. So for us, I think we are very fortunate in some ways that we have a Dharma right around us right now, right here. And we have a beautiful center and a beautiful teacher in the lay urban community. It becomes become a lot more accessible to many of us. You know, we can come in the middle of the day for a couple of hours to share a Dharma and meditate. And it wasn't the case in the Buddha's time. You would have to be a monastic order or really leave home to do that. And so I often reflect that I think the way that we practice now is different. And we are very fortunate that we have a lot more accessibility to the Dharma, to the teachings, and to the Sangha. And we have a wonderful teachers here that support us as well. And so our involvement in the world, in the family, is no longer need to be necessarily so separated. And so our presence will set our kids heart in certain ways, and that hopefully move towards more of a well-being and compassionate individual rather than, you know, mean and selfish individual. And so in some ways I felt like we have a much bigger room in our ways of a practice than the you know, 2500 years ago. And so Dharma is manifesting in many other ways now for us. Yeah. So I do wonder, because there are other interpretations of fetter, Rahula's name, that wasn't necessarily impediment for the Buddha, but it was rather, it was a fetter for the Rahula himself, because when one is born, you know, it's because we're not finished. So it is a fetter. It's a very matter of a fact of naming it. And so there are other interpretations in the commentaries and so on. So we don't have to kind of hold it in one particular way. It's really just how we hold it, and that's supportive for us, and that's more relevant in our lives. Yeah. So just know that the fact that you're here on the Tuesday morning and spending the quiet time, that's quite an offering for yourself and for the world. So, I think we have to stop. Thank you.